Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is TV Take, Variety's television podcast. I'm Daniel Holloway. Today we talk with Mark Guggenheim, executive producer of Netflix's animated series Three Below. Later, critics Caroline Framke and Daniel Daddario will discuss their Dream Emmy nominees. Stay tuned. Mark Guggenheim, thank you for doing this.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you've got Three Below, which is part of the Arcadia series of animated shows that you and Guillermo del Toro do for Netflix. There's new episodes of that coming up soon. Can you talk about, first of all, the world that you guys have created in which you have like several shows that you're going to, this is the second of a trilogy, right?
That's right. Yeah, we're doing basically Tales of Arcadia is the umbrella, and that includes Trollhunters, Three Below, and then a third series that will be coming out called Wizards. And it is this huge, expansive universe where, with Three Below, we're actually literally making it a universe with multiple planets and leaving Earth and also returning to Arcadia, which is where Trollhunters was set.
And how much of that world was built out at the time that you guys sort of pitched this and developed this?
About a third of the way through production on Trollhunters, DreamWorks and Netflix came to Guillermo and said, we would love more. we would like more of what you're giving us. And Guillermo had come up with the idea for Three Below and then later for Wizards. And because we knew that we were going to be doing these shows, you know, fairly early on in the process of Trollhunters, we were able to basically lay the foundation for both series in Trollhunters. So you meet Aja and Krell, you meet Dooksy, you meet the various characters that, you know, sort of come to the fore in the two series, the two spin-off series.
Now, in the show, Aja and Krell are an alien prince and princess who are, they're basically on the run after a coup overthrows their family, and they're hiding out in this town, Arcadia. They're essentially refugees who are living in hiding.
That's
so
right.
This is a kid's show, but considering that you have that as its premise, how much do you guys talk about leaning into the sort of, like, cultural, social tones?
That's a great question. You know, Guillermo is an immigrant himself, as is Rodrigo Blas, who also is the co-director on the pilots. And we talked a lot about what the immigrant experience was like. And it was important for us to sort of, you know, shine a light on that experience. Well, at the same time, you know, it's a family show. It's a kid's show. It's not a polemic. But we wanted to just sort of tell a story about people, you know, coming from, you know, their home to a foreign place. The funny thing is that when you look at, I think, drama, immigrant stories they make up so much of our narrative tapestry. And it's only in relatively recent times that that's even become a quote unquote political thing. So for us, it was a matter of how do we just, you know, we take the politics out of it and just tell a story about what it's like to be a stranger in a strange land.
And you have also one of the third principal character in the series is
Varvatos
Vex.
Yeah. Yes.
Who's voiced by Nick Offerman. And I'm wondering, when you have someone like Offerman as voice talent and you're going into a second season, how much are you writing to what Nick is able to do? Because he obviously has a really distinctive cadence.
He does. And, you know, the particular take on that character was something that Nick worked out, you know, hand in hand with Guillermo. You know, Guillermo was there for his first few records, and they sort of found the character together. And then, of course, once you hear it, you can't help but start writing to it. And the whole way that came together was just very organic, because while we were doing the records on season one, we were writing season two. So we were able to take what we were hearing in the recording booth and basically bring it into the writer's room.
And the joke of the Varvatos character is that he is, you know, this incredibly powerful alien warrior who is disguised in the body of an elderly man who loves chess,
who discovers chess on Earth, and that becomes his, you know, sort of entry point into Earth, the thing that he learns about human culture that he is just very enamored of.
As you said, this the idea of evolving and extending the original series into this broader world was something that came along after you guys were already working on Trollhunters. How has your approach to making these shows changed or evolved since that original first season of Trollhunters?
That's a great question. I would say the way I describe it is Trollhunters is telling a very classic, you know, Joseph Campbell hero's journey story. I like to think we tell it well, but we're telling that, you know, very tried and true, you know, structure. Whereas with Three Below, we very intentionally, we wanted to push the comedy. We wanted to make it a bit more oddball, a bit more quirky. We wanted to try to tell a different kind of story, a story that perhaps was less familiar. And then with Wizards, we're basically looking to sort of bring everything together. I think in many ways, Wizards combines like some of the, you know, the traditional narrative elements of Trollhunters with the quirky oddball humor of Three Below. So you sort of see how everything gets, you know, cohesive with Wizards.
You worked on the Arrowverse shows, and you're producing the upcoming crossover, which has become a bigger and bigger thing every year. And I'm wondering, is there something similar to that in what you're doing, where you have shows where the tone is like maybe different from one to another by a few degrees, but all has to exist in this world where it's like, okay, I believe those two things exist side by side?
Absolutely. In fact, the early conversations about Three Below that I had with the studio were mainly centered around the experience, you know, I had doing the Arrowverse shows. And the thing that, for me, I take from the Arrowverse experience is a quote-unquote spinoff can't be a spinoff. It has got to stand on its own four legs. It has got to be its own show. It's got to have its own identity, even though it, quote-unquote, spun off from a show or is part of a shared universe. It has to be its own thing. So if you, like, go back and you look at the pile of Three Below, you'll see, even though Toby from Trollhunters makes an appearance in the second episode, you know, if you hadn't watched Trollhunters, you'd be perfectly fine. You don't need to have experienced Trollhunters in order to understand what's going on in Three Below. Similarly, you won't have had to have watched Three Below and Trollhunters in order to understand Wizards. And that really was, you know, the lesson of the Arrowverse experience.
My experience watching the first episode of Three Below was, watching the second, which was the first one that I saw, was my son watching it, seeing Toby from Trollhunters come by and saying, "Wait, is that the kid from Trollhunters?" And then having my then 6-year-old explain to me the, like, universe mythology of the show, and I immediately felt sympathy for my own parents. You're also working on Carnival Row for Amazon, and I wanted to see if you could tell us what that experience has been like so far and where you guys are at with that.
You know, it's terrific. It's been a really great experience because you know, Travis Beecham, the co-creator of the show, he has just created such this rich, vibrant world that's totally original. The thing that, you know, I think the two things that attracted me to the project were, number one, just how, you know, profound the concept is. The concept, it deals with issues of immigration and issues of racism and classism and sexism, all these things that we're talking about in our society today are represented in this genre show. And I think genre always, you know, has an easier time of holding a mirror up to society than necessarily, you know, non-genre shows do. The other thing that really attracted me was this world had never existed before. It doesn't, you know, it's not based on a novel. It's not based on a graphic novel. It's not based on a movie. It's its own unique animal. And I think we need more of that. You know, we need more of that in television where we are breaking new ground, and that's what, you know, this show does.
That was one of the things that surprised me about it was that it's something that is created from whole cloth that you aren't based on IP.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I think, you know, pre-awareness is fine. You know, The Godfather was based on IP. Sure. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think, you know, there needs to be in our industry more of a balance between the pre-awareness IP-based projects and the ones that are, you know, like you say, whole cloth, you know, and that, you know, Carnival Row just scratches that other itch.
Creatively, how freeing is that for you? Because you get to, for instance, you can decide how magic works. You can decide how the politics of this world work.
Yeah, actually, what's terrific is you can kind of go anywhere and do anything. At the same time, one of the things that Travis has done is he has figured out a lot of things. Now, just because, you know, he's got it written down in a notebook doesn't mean we're beholden to it, but it's great to have that as a structure and a framework to work off of, because what it allows you to do is create a world that feels lived in, that feels real and tactile. The fact that, like, you know, Travis, you know, the show really takes place in one city, the Burg, but Travis has an entire global map with the names of every single country in that world. So it's great to know that if we want to refer to Ignota, we can refer to Ignota. We don't have to invent these things. They are already there for us, and it makes the world feel real.
The show takes place in a, without giving anything away, it's sort of fantasy in a modern, in a more contemporary context.
Yeah, it's a much more modern context than you expect from, like, Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings. The way we sort of describe it is, imagine if you saw, you know, Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, and those worlds aged basically into the Industrial Age. So we're basically at a place in this fantasy world where we are just slightly, you know, post-industrial age.
You were talking earlier about the ability of, you know, fantasy and science fiction to hold a mirror up to society in ways sometimes that, you know, naturalistic stuff can't. When you're doing something like this that is genre but is in a more contemporary context, does that give you more power to sort of create things that are maybe more directly analogous to our world than if it was a classic, like, medieval sort of fantasy story?
I think so. You know, I think there's certainly that opportunity. The trick, I think, is wielding that opportunity in a responsible way. Like I said, trying to avoid it being a polemic. I will say what's interesting is, you know, this project has been in development for a good number of years, and Travis originally wrote it as a feature 15 years ago. And what has been so interesting to me is the issues of immigration and the issues of refugees from a war-torn country have actually only become more topical and more relevant in the modern day than it was, you know, 15 years ago. So in some cases, it's not that the reflections of the real world are so much as intentional as the show has just, you know, grown to reflect the world outside our window, albeit with mythological creatures and, you know, a Victorian kind of setting.
How much, when you're creating a show like this, how much are you thinking about what audience expectations are now? Because we're in a post-Game of Thrones world.
Yes.
And we expect everything to be happening on a movie scale with a show that exists specifically in these genres.
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about the audience. You know, we talk a lot about what their expectations are. I will say for Travis and me, we're that audience. So the audience's expectations are actually our expectations and vice versa. You know, I don't think we've ever sat in a production meeting, though, and said, okay, well, this has got to be really big, or we have got to have this many set pieces in per episode. We're just trying to tell the best story we can, and we're just very lucky that we're living at a time when the resources that are available to us as producers are just so great. It's not like we're trying to catch Game of Thrones. In fact, you know, it's the Game of Thrones comparisons are inevitable and unavoidable. At the same time, this show is so different from Game of Thrones. Yes, it has fantasy elements, and yes, it has a big scope and a, you know, a very generous budget, but it's very, very different from Game of Thrones. I think people who tune in expecting it to be a Game of Thrones, Game of Thrones clone is they're going to be disappointed. But if they come to it on its own terms, I think they'll be really excited.
When you're making something like this, how much are you, because you're making it for Amazon, you know, how much are you able to sort of work on all parts of the season at once, as opposed to sort of the way that you've worked in the past in broadcast, where you're kind of going, you know, episode by episode?
The best part about doing a streaming show with a short order is you get to do all eight scripts before you start production. And that's a huge benefit. One of the things we discovered in prep was the fact that the more material we had in advance of actual shooting, the better everything could be. You end up being able to put every single dollar on the screen. You're able to just, you know, maximize all your opportunities. You're able to maximize your locations. You're able to maximize your extras. It's just all these, like, little production things that come, you know, they just come to you as opportunities, to the point where when we were doing additional photography on the first season, and Travis and I had written some various sequences that we sort of described as the irresponsible version of the sequences. We basically were like, we're going to write the Cadillac version, and then we're going to have Amazon and Legendary pull us back. And we ended up not making a single change to save money. It was basically Amazon and Legendary were like, that's great, do that. You know, the only change we made was the end of the first episode involves this very elaborate rooftop chase sequence. And we originally scripted it as taking place in the rain, because we thought that would be cool. And Travis and I both love Blade Runner. But we made the compromise of losing the rain, not for money, but for safety. When our stunt team told us that there was no way to safely wire the actors so that they could run on these slick rooftops, we were like, Just lose that. But again, you're making, you know, compromises for, you know, real practical reasons, and not to try to hit a budgetary number, which is a really, it's a wonderful thing. But you only get to do that if you have all the scripts written in advance.
You've worked on genre shows in the past. You write comic books. You live sort of squarely in this world. Are you surprised when you look at the fact that you can get something like Carnival Row made and the producers are not pushing back on cost, when you look at the impact that Game of Thrones has had, when you look at the shows in the Arrowverse that you've worked on running for as long as they have, just to see how popular that all of this stuff that, you know, until recently was ghettoized has become?
Well, it's funny, as you were talking, the word that was in my, you know, head was ghetto. Like, for the longest time, you know, comic books and genre, science fiction and fantasy, they occupied basically this pop culture ghetto. And, you know, no one was buying comics. No one was certainly going to these kinds of movies. I mean, yes, obviously, like, there's Star Wars as an exception. But for the most part, it's not until relatively recently that genre has taken over all aspects of media and all corners of pop culture. Am I surprised? I guess so. I mean, it's funny. I don't know if I really thought of it in terms of being surprised. I am old enough that I remember the period of, like, comic books, when comic books were always considered for kids. And to the extent they weren't considered for kids, it was always a surprise. Like, you know, the first – I mean, God, it took forever just to be able to get an article written about a comic book in a paper that didn't start off with some variation on, bow, piff, zap, comic books aren't for kids anymore. God, like, it took forever for us to get past that. So I come from a standpoint not of surprise, but rather of gratitude. I'm just really glad that comic books and genre and science fiction and fantasy aren't treated this way anymore.
Mark, thank you very much.
Awesome. This was fun.
The nominees for the Primetime Emmy Awards will be announced Tuesday, July 16th. Daniel Daddario and Caroline Framke talked about who their ideal nominees would be.
The Emmy nominations are out on July 16th, and as always, there are way more shows than slots available for nominations, and since Dan and I watch more TV than just about anyone, we have so many shows and people we'd love to see nominated, and we want to talk about them a little bit, because We are not totally confident their names will come up next week, so we want to make sure to give them a shout out in some other way on this podcast. It's equivalent, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, voting for the Emmy nominations has closed, so we can't sway hearts and minds of all the many, many Emmy voters who I know are listening. However, I hope we're sending some good vibes out into the universe for these really talented people who maybe aren't traditional Emmy favorites, but who are responsible for some of the season's most memorable to us work and really, as you say, rise above the clutter of the hours and hours and hours a day we watch.
Exactly. So today we thought we'd start with comedy for a reason. And that reason is that this year for us has really been defined by amazing, smart comedies. Too many, far too many for the Emmys to recognize. So we wanted to shout out a few of them today. In terms of shows themselves, one show that I think hasn't maybe gotten its due as it wound down, it did when it first premiered because it was new and interesting, is Broad City. I think that show, which ended in earlier this year after five seasons, really brought itself to a smart an emotional close. I wasn't frankly expecting it to be that emotional, though looking back, I should have seen it coming. So I thought that creators Abby Jacobson and Alana Glazer deserve a little bit more formal recognition than they have gotten for it.
Yeah, interestingly enough, I share your kind of esteem for the final season, and I thought it ended really nicely. But I also just think it's interesting as a kind of observer of these things that it does seem as though that Comedy Central is kind of campaigning them, that they've put them forward. And I think that that's nice at least to see the confidence behind them. These are two people who are going to have really great careers, I think.
Exactly. And I think Broad City's influence, it was immediately felt in a lot of copycats that I don't think came anywhere near what they actually do. And I think its influence is still being felt today. So I wanted to shout them out. Let's see. For comedy, I think one we both agree on, if you want to talk a little bit about this one, is Pen 15, Hulu's coming-of-age comedy from Anna Conkle and Maya Erskine, which we both love.
Yeah, absolutely. This is kind of, I think, the most impressive of an increasingly impressive suite of shows on Hulu. They've really kind of found a niche that works for them in kind of offbeat minor key comedies.
I love that.
Yeah, just like things that are a little bit kind of
bittersweet.
Bittersweet and kind of a note that not everyone can hear. Pen 15, I know as many people who are totally alienated by the premise, which is that those creators and actresses you named play versions of themselves as, very young teens in the early 2000s. And their castmates are all actual young teens. And so it's like 30-something, early 30-something women kind of play acting their adolescence, but doing so with this total physical commitment. And this really kind of like moving story. In a way, it's kind of like a junior Broad City. It's these two kind of us against the world girls going through middle school with all the emotional turbulence and social angst that implies.
Yeah, I think you can. I could absolutely see them, 10 years later living together in some shitty New York apartment trying to make it through. So that's a really smart observation.
Yeah.
And proves my point about the influence.
Absolutely.
And I love being right.
I think that it is in the vein of Broad City, perhaps, not that it's not totally its own thing, but maybe they wouldn't have had the confidence to, Hulu wouldn't have had the confidence to put as much money and as much promotional muscle as they did behind this if Broad City hadn't proven to be a hit.
Yes.
Talking about a couple performers in the comedy world that we like, another thing that you and I agree on is that on the generally superlative, the other two, Molly Shannon is absolutely terrific. There's a line when she, her character, who is the momager of a young pop star, she's on a talk show and she's describing the children's book she wrote. And she describes it as having, I think, 8 very thick pages. It's just like, it's this satire that is so kind of winning and loving, and she does not hate her character, but she sees her for kind of the somewhat silly, deluded person that she is caught up in this machinery. It's just a really sharp performance.
Yeah, and I think not for nothing, the comedy supporting categories have been pretty saturated with SNL stars as of late, and this would be a really good way to honor an SNL star for another kind of performance, so that's something I'm really into. And speaking of supporting comedy players, who I think deserve a little bit more recognition, I would say Russian Doll, which I've talked about ad nauseum on this podcast, so I won't like keep going on it, but I do think that Charlie Barnett did incredible work on it, and I wish that he were more in the conversation in the way that Natasha Lyonne currently is.
I feel the same way about Sarah Goldberg, and I think this is another one we agree on.
From Barry.
Who, if the world were fair, would be getting the kind of notices that Henry Winkler, who won an Emmy for the show last year and is likely to be nominated again, and Bill Hader, who won an Emmy for the show last year and is likely to be nominated again. It's funny. I feel like genre confusion may play a role in that Goldberg, who plays this kind of actress who's kind of aging out of the moment in her life when it's even realistic to hope that it might happen for her, but she kind of keeps on pushing and keeps searching and keeps trying to deepen her craft and keeps trying to find the right role. It's actually very moving, poignant, and outright sad. And I think it doesn't quite slot into comedy, certainly less so than Winkler's performance. So I feel like it gets a little bit lost, but she's doing incredible work.
There's one moment she has this monologue where she's panicking about an audition, and she hits so many different emotional beats in that one moment that I was like, she's someone that I think we should be talking about a lot more. And I think her storyline in general is a big part of why Barry season 2 worked.
Agreed.
But as long as we're, you know, and again, we have said this before, so loyal listeners, you know that we think Barry is a drama.
Yes.
But speaking
Let's
of
drama. The things that are officially slotted as dramas.
Exactly. So in the drama sphere, we identified mostly performers who we'd like to see nominated. And in that vein, I would say do you think we'll see Killing Eve represented, which I did not love the second season as much as I wanted to by any stretch, but I do believe that the deserved praise for Sandra Oh has eclipsed Jodie Comer in a way that I am sad about, because I think she's giving an incredible performance every week in this season. Especially, she had to carry a lot of story beats that just didn't make as much sense, and she really sold them in a way that it took me maybe longer than it should have to be like, what's going on with this season?
Yeah. It's interesting looking at the way Killing Eve is generally received now that I think it is a major hit. And I think that kind of the stage has been set, especially with the category kind of emptying out of last year's winner and a lot of its nominees, for to take the prize. She didn't just win a Golden Globe. She hosted the ceremony. She's kind of having a bit of a cultural moment. And it takes nothing away from her to say that I think Comer does. It's like that adage about how Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did, but like backwards and in heels. I just think it's like a more complicated, it's the more complicated role of the pairing.
Yeah.
And I think it's just never has a false moment, despite how incredibly strange and odd the situations the character finds herself in are.
Yeah, I think if O's character were played by anyone but O, Jodie Comer would be having a moment kind of like Tatiana Maslany in Orphan mm-hmm. Black, where it's the same sort of shapeshiftery role that announces her in such a big way. So I don't think she's in any danger of being forgotten in general. Would love to see her in the nominations. But as long as we're talking performances, we also identified a couple supporting that we'd like to see. I think it's pretty safe to say that these categories will be overwhelmed by Game of Thrones people.
Yes.
But I would love to hear from you on a couple of supporting people that you're into.
Yeah, I think that Jarrell Jerome, who is in an interesting position in When They See Us, where he's one of the so-called Central Park Five, five young men who were imprisoned for a crime they were later found not to have committed and freed, and he kind of has a smaller presence in the early going, and then the final episode of this limited series is really all him. And I do feel like it's hard to stand out in these limited series categories if you're not a major star. But I think that this is a star-making performance for someone who was as good as he was in Moonlight. And now this, he kind of anchors this episode growing up in prison, kind of, and struggling to find his way even after he's out, having been socialized within that world. This is being campaigned as a lead. I could say,
see, oh, it going, is.
No, this next one is.
Oh, I see.
Joey King is being campaigned as a lead for the act. I could see it going either way, but she certainly is another young person who I think people are now alive to quite how talented she is. She plays Gypsy Rose Blanchard, a young woman at the center of a famous true crime case who was made sick by her Munchausen mom, and King plays such an interesting mixture of insecurity, naivete, wanting to be free of her mom, but also knowing that she not only isn't quite able to be, like, wouldn't know what to do with herself, but also is kind of, like, addicted to the sickness of their relationship in her own way. It's a really adult performance by a very young performer, and I think that as competitive as that category is with stars like Amy Adams of Sharp Objects and Michelle Williams from Fozzie Verdon, I would really like to see King represented as much as I would like to see Jerome, and kind of introduce a new generation to the Emmy stage.
I love that. So very quickly before we leave, we, as you can probably tell, we could go on about this forever.
Oh, yeah.
Let's just mention a couple drama series that we'd like to see represented more. For me, I will stump for Stars as Vita, which did campaign. It's a half hour, but it did campaign to be considered in the drama category, which I think is correct, and more people should do it.
Yes.
People, shows, you know what I mean. I think it's really smart. It did a portrait of two Mexican-American sisters coming back to their hometown in East L.A. and trying to grapple with that. And particularly, I think Michelle Prada has done a really astonishing job with a really tough character. And what about you?
I would stump for another dramatic limited series, which is Maniac, a show that I think I like more than most and that I think has been pretty widely kind of just the culture kind of moved on from. But I think that it's really beautifully done. The story of kind of two people finding each other in the midst of kind of pharmaceutical drug trial and kind of working together to overcome their various traumas from their past. I think Emma Stone, it's hard to feel bad that Emma Stone, one of the biggest stars in Hollywood, isn't getting enough attention, but I think she's really special in it. I think she's doing really dialed in work. And I think that the show generally, and she specifically, would be well worth recognizing if only it's sitting there on Netflix for people to discover in the years ahead. And I hope they do. But if they don't, there's always more TV where that came from.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with Danielle Brooks of Orange is the New Black.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.